listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial, www.ckut.ca on the internet. The Women's World 2011 conference is taking place in Ottawa from July 3rd to July 7th. The theme of the conference is Inclusions, Exclusions, and Seclusions, Living in a Globalized World. Around the world, women are grappling with changing political, cultural, economic, social and environmental realities, and the effect of numerous crises, be it economic, ecological, or health-related, intensify obstacles to women's equality. Globalization has contributed to the destabilization and marginalization of women and community. Our guest speaker on issues of women's empowerment and gender equality is Mrs. Jocelyn Talbot, Senior Gender Advisor for the UN Development Program. She is now stationed in Pristina, Kosovo. For the last 25 years, Mrs. Talbot has been working tirelessly in the Middle East and Africa, where she was stationed in Lebanon, Egypt, Palestine, Jordan, and Yemen. I met Mrs. Talbot at the Women's World Conference in Ottawa yesterday. She's with us on the line. Welcome, Jocelyn, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Jocelyn, when we talk about the elements that should be introduced to promote women's empowerment and gender equality, what is on top of the list?
Well, thank you, first of all, for allowing me to have some moment and to be able to transmit some of the information and some of the consensus. Not only do women have to do the network, but I mean, more important, and I think this is coming very strongly in every segment of populations or nations that have been addressed this global conference, is that the decision-making process is very important, but also holding decision making positions to ensure that they can transform whatever structure they're into, whether it's parliament, municipalities, schools, where they can ensure that the needs of women and young girls, and I would say also young men, are translated concretely in the budget and also the direction in which the programs and planning should be done. Now, this sounds very evident, or this sounds to that we would hope that this is what good governance is all about. But if you do not have these populations with voices to represent themselves and to ensure that the whole cycle of governance really transforms, it's not going to happen.
Well, if we want the women to participate, what would be the best tool for empowerment and also to accomplish or to reach gender equality? How do you go about motivating these women or allowing them to participate in the society or giving them the forum to do so?
Okay, number one, I would say that it's not an issue of motivation because they are motivated, but no one was capturing or giving or preparing bridges for them to transfer their information or to join the groups where they could learn. I've heard a very good experience yesterday in one of the sessions. It's about municipalities and having short internship for young women who could would want or perhaps have all the elements of leadership and mentoring them in order to understand better the ropes of municipal politics and the way we should run a business and even the municipalities as an elder person or even taking some leadership into private enterprises. And my understanding from all the experience that we've hearing here or in Egypt or in Kosovo or even in Palestine is that show us and allow us to observe, to semi-participate, then later we will understand and we can have a greater contribution. So motivation is there.
Yes, so it's really the process of including the women in the political process.
Well, I will say, because we're discussing this debate of what is inclusion, very often women are already in the process. It's not, we don't say women in development. Women are in development. Women are part of the inclusions, and they are in. But two points. They may be visible, but they're not heard. and they may be visible, not heard, so therefore no actions or programs are supporting them. So they are in the party, they are included, or if I may say, in the decision making. Now, if you look at hardcore politics, if you look at hardcore budgets, if you look at how politicians make decisions, then you can make an analysis, a gender analysis of their programs, and you will see that in the last elections, they barely talk about half of the population and even more. They barely talk about the different types of services that they would ensure that their half of this population could be more efficient and can be given better benefits. And this is not even discussed anymore. So the inclusion is not sufficient in quantity, but in quality and programs representing this inclusion and giving them all the ropes. And I say giving, I'm saying allowing and opening the space, because the higher you go in the hierarchy, the more these spaces are closed. So women have to work vertically and horizontally to ensure that they can drill this.
Very good, Jocelyn. So tell me about the tools that the UN uses to measure this inclusion or to measure women's participation, because there are some benchmarks, and I know that countries are rated according to how much women have accomplished equality or how much equality they have achieved. So if you'd like to explain to us what are the indicators?
Well, there are many accountable, I call it the gender accountability mechanisms that is currently going on within the UNDP, from what I know, in 166 countries. There's always the UNDP country offices supporting the national women's machinery to be able to write these reports or shadow reports and to support writing it about what is the accountability, did the government or the authority where they are, have they been in line with the international treaties and so on. So you have the national and international. What is very interesting about UNDP is that we have a gender global strategy for the past 5 years with very clear indicators as far as empowering women in economy, having them included in the decision-making of all the governance cycle, looking into the climate change and environment and the green economy. But what's important is that we can have these great principles and these reports, but we wanted to make accountable not only our partners but the country offices. So we have mechanisms such as gender marker, which are part of an economic and financial system whereby we can trace if the country offices are delivering within a gender equality and women empowerment. Since 2007, we, especially with the Security Council 1325, we engaged in 8-point agenda, which has a very comprehensive approach. For example, are we working on women's security in crisis? What are we doing about gender-based violence, access to justice, cultural rights? Are we working on peace process? Are we supporting young women and young men to be part of these agreements? Are we working in disaster risk reduction, meaning at the municipality level and national level? Are the populations being not just targeted as beneficiaries, but are they part of the planning? Do we have governments or country offices that are really delivering for gender equality and women empowerment? Now, these are not just principles. We have the indicators, and we have a system where we can count the budget lines to see if this is really supporting and going according to the quota of the gender equality and women empowerment.
Jocelyn Talbot, I want to ask you here about the Arab and Muslim societies in particular, and you've lived in those areas mm-hmm. for so long. Mm-hmm. Now, you know that the terms empowerment and mm-hmm. equality don't go down well. They're perceived as Western concepts. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. In those society, people talk more about complementary roles. Do you think really that complementary. It's not going to be acceptable here that we have to stick to this question of equality, everything equal. Do you navigate the cultural differences? I'd like you to comment on this.
Well, what I'd like to say is that I'd like to remind you that when the UNDP regional for the Arab States, the regional national human or regional human report came out as empowering women in the Arab States, there was a whole debate on the word empowering, as if, and that's true. So we removed this this concept, or we removed this note, and it was to say women are very strong. We have very smart, all women in the Arab States are very, very strong. They are strong at the municipality level. They are strong at the different levels. It's an issue of recognizing this and citing it and pushing it forward. So they felt that the word empowerment was more of a sentence which they were incapable of. And we, this is the whole debate in capacity and capabilities. So we said, no, the women have the capacities, not the capabilities, and having the space where they can do that. So whether in the Arab States where I've been, and I've been to 18 of them, whether they're Christians, Muslim, or any other religions, frankly, at the different level, when we started measuring and looking with a gender lens, these capabilities, it's just amazing, the powerhouse that was existing. Now, of course, they were glass ceiling, and I think in the different, especially with the Egyptian revolution, we saw that for the past five years.
We'll come to the revolution in a little while, but okay. You're bringing a very good point. You went to those 18 countries. Here in the West, we tend to see the Arab world socially, politically, as one entity. That's now, there are nuances, probably. Not, I would say probably, but definitely in those countries. And I want you to comment on this particular point.
Well, I think we can never see a whole continent as one. I mean, it's impossible. You don't say this about North America. I mean, there are nuances. But in the Arab States, especially through the UNDP, we used to divide them by low income, middle income, and so on. But now we have new indicators, the type of governance, you know, and all of it now is shaking. So how are we going to redefine this? Do we just go through the economy, or do we also look at the issue of governance? And is this a bigger indicator in order to redefine? I mean, if today we redefine, so how many are in crisis? Most of the Arab states are in crisis right now. It's not necessarily a tsunami disaster, but they're all trembling, you see? So how do we redefine this? Of course, we have to go now to the governance. And I remember very well when we launched the regional development human report on governance, most of the authorities of different Arab states were furious because we were starting to define them not as their economy, but as their governance.
And
how
the democracy,
they were made
accountable. There was a great, debate and reservations about the notion of democracy, right?
Yes, but they say democracy, but we knew it was about governance. We're still having monarchy, we're still having corrupted groups, and so on. So this is another type of, are we going to, you know, I mean, it's a huge debate even in policy making. So how do we define countries? Is it just by their financial statement, or is it also by the National Human Development Index, or is it also how they govern, how they make themselves accountability, transparency, and so on, not only at the national level, but municipal level? And I think in the coming months, I mean, I think now we're going to start taking more indicators to be able to define the Arab states.
You're going to start over because everything has been demolished. So.
Well, I would not say that it has been demolished. I would say that corruption is being uprooted. And if it's an intifada, it's an intifada against the corruption. And it's also, it's the whole issue of accountability. It's no longer you run and you direct us, but it is, you have to work for us, the people, the men and the women. And I think this is a very, very strong lesson
absolutely.
In Tunisia and in Egypt. It is, it's not about religions. It's about men and women who are saying, listen, enough is enough, kifaya. Now, and I think they're giving a lesson to the rest of the world of what real accountability is. It's not just about NGOs and associations. It's people who are not necessarily also in an associative grouping. It's the citizen. And I think this is what we're seeing, the rebirth of what citizenship should mean. And I think it's not easy, but it's one of the most healthiest point in democracy.
Absolutely, and I want to correct myself when I said that the old regime were destroyed. Well, good riddance. I don't want anyone to think that I regretted it.
And No.
And yeah. Since we're talking about the Arab Spring, now, the Western media didn't report much about the women's role on the political scene. I mean, and suddenly we find the women in the streets, at the forefront of demonstrations, and mm-hmm. also in very important support roles. Were you surprised?
No, I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask. I'm not surprised. I mean, I've spent 27 years, and trust me, I knew exactly. We didn't just know when it was going to happen. I was not surprised because I think in one of our previous discussion, I had mentioned the following. If anyone in the Western world thinks that this was something that happened overnight, I think they have to go back to their desk and start learning again, because this was not a spontaneity. Just in Egypt, in the past 5 years, there was more than 2,000 either strikes or demonstrations. From Malha, you remember all these women struggling. I mean, there's been struggles for years. And I mean, if you make the calculation in past 5 years, that means twice a day there was a demonstration. Now, why did not people see it? Why the media did not look into this? Were they busy with, United States? Were they looking at other areas? And, you know, there's been so many signs. But, in fact, it took us also by surprise to see not just the thousands of people that they used to say. I know, I was directly in contact with the streets. We were talking millions, but the media still covering. The media was slow to react, and the media, I don't think they knew exactly what to expect.
And not only the media. I can tell you that Mr. Obama and Hillary Clinton, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to expect. They didn't know where this came from, in spite of all the intelligence they had in the country.
That also tells you where the intelligence was working at this time, because they were more working with the military to see if the money that was received at Camp David is well spent or not, etc. They even had their powerhouse in Washington to be discussing. So they felt that this was more or less quiet. And we know that outsiders, if they just look at those parameters, I mean, they were completely, completely taken. And I will say that the Arab states are not necessarily surprised, because if they were so surprised, they would not engage. For the past 30 years, show me one Arab state who is not starting to, I wouldn't say to crumble, but to shake. There is not one, unless there is a new Arab state that I'm not aware of. I don't think there is one Arab state who can, the leaders can go to bed at night and say, we have very quite well organized, everyone is satisfied. The satisfaction has been
they had no illusion that everyone was satisfied or even on the road to satisfaction. They knew that people were against them, and they maintained...
Yeah, but they put the mechanism to
the repression.
To keep them quiet, absolutely.
That was the problem. So we're very happy that things are changing now.
But I think one of their mistakes that they've done, they've dealt with the systems of repression, the system of this, the system of that. They completely forgot about the power of people. And I think this is our greatest lesson. And I'm very proud to say that I was there, I've been there, I've been around. But they're strong. And we always bet, even when those start giving up, you know, this system is there, it will be replaced by. But people, you know, we have so many example in past histories, whether it's in Europe or elsewhere, where once the people, the conjunctions, there will be so many analyses, enough. Enough is enough. And all these get together, I mean, you cannot. We are human beings. This is the dignity of people. And I remember Nelson Mandela when he was making his speech when he was receiving the medals of freedom and so on. It was in Holland. And the Queen Beatrice was sitting there, and all the dignitaries were there. And he was looking at them, and he says, "You're sitting in front of me, but don't think this is a good reason to sit in front of me, because I cannot look at you without thinking that. There are still people at night who wonder where they're going to sleep. There are still people who are not eating. And you tell me if this is human dignity. You tell me if this is civilization. And frankly, I think we have a lot of respect for this old lion, but he's so right, because it's about the dignity of people. You cannot, you can torture people, you can try all the suppressive systems, but you cannot take away inside their dignity.
And Jocelyne Talbot, may I ask you what Canadian women, Arab, Muslim, and others can do to help promote dignity, woman empowerment, and I'm not afraid to use this word, in our globalized system?
Well, I can tell you right now, I mean, some people here ask me tonight, today in Ottawa, you know, can we go and help the women in Egypt, you know, to move on? There's so many organizations in Egypt that were there, but they were overshadowed by Suzanne Mubarak, you know, with her team and so on. But they're there. They are the ones who help collecting all the testimonies of brutalities that took place in Tahrir with identification in such a manner that evil lawyers were just absolutely flabbergasted. And all this was used by the prosecutor. They are the ones who are leading the committee still up to now to collect as more information as not. So empowered there are, and they are visible, they are busy, and trust me, they will be heard, because now they're preparing, if you are aware of that. There's many conferences right now and sessions with women from all paths from Egypt trying to discuss and saying, what are our assets? What is the great capabilities that we do have? How are we going to tackle the election that is coming? And how are we going to make sure that in the new constitutions, we will make sure that we safeguard our gains? So now there's a whole debate on quota and so on. But they are organizing. They are not waiting for foreigners or even for Arab neighbors to come and support them. They're able, now they have more space to move around without repression, and they are doing it. That doesn't mean there's still no repression. But what I'm saying is that the space to move around and to organize and to have a discussion is completely open. There's the blockage or the blockade has been removed. So
thank
now
you.
They will
thank
be
you very much.
Hear them.
Yes, that's very encouraging news. And we thank you so much, Jocelyne Talbot, for sharing this with us. I'm sure many of our listeners are very pleased to hear from you at last for after this long absence. And I hope you'll find the time to visit us in Montreal after the Women's World Conference in Ottawa ending July 7th.
Wallah, inshallah. I have something with McGill. One day, you remember the old days when we were supporting all
the good causes.
Yes. The good causes and women's causes and Palestinian causes, etc. And we don't stop. I think we all work very hard for where we are, and we continue pursuing. And one of the, and I congratulate you for your program, because we need to give the real picture of what is going on, not the romantic one that I heard today. There was two women, you know, sort of. I said, listen, people are still suffering, but the story of Egypt is a story of 30 years, a lot of years of people struggling, going to prison, having to sometimes to leave their country to come back. So there is a lot of respect for these people. Now the challenge is that let us build this new Egypt together. So.
Yes,
we hope so.
We hope so, inshallah.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jocelyne.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.